The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Stuart Epstein. I am the very proud husband of tonight's featured speaker, Randy Hutter Epstein. Real thrill for me and for both of us to be here at the Free Library for two principal reasons. One, the city of Philadelphia is very important and special to the two of us. We met only a short distance from here at the University of Pennsylvania as college freshmen 38 years ago. Yes, my math is correct. Second reason is I get to introduce my very special wife to all of you. She has accomplished an awful lot since we met and continues to accomplish a bunch. She earned her BA from Penn. She has two master's degrees from Columbia, first in journalism and subsequently in public health. And she has an MD from Yale University, where she currently teaches undergraduate English. Aroused, The History of Hormones, is her second book and follows Get Me Out, The History of Childbirth. So yeah, she likes the catchy book titles, and they work. They get people to things like this. And she did all of this while raising our four children. So an accomplished woman indeed. So tonight marks the official launch of Aroused. Day one, the book came out today. So this is our first event. We are particularly excited to be kicking it off here at the Free Library. I'm told the mission of this esteemed institution is to, quote, advance literacy, guide learning, and inspire curiosity. So what a perfect place to kick off our nationwide promotional tour for an author, and we're very appreciative and honored to have been asked to do so. So Randy set out to do a few things with Aroused. She wanted to make it readable, make it smart, and to teach people with different levels of understanding and background, and importantly, to earn the respect of both the literary and the science communities. I believe she's accomplished all that and much more, and so do some of the early reviewers that have come out today in the recent weeks. So if I've learned one thing in the close to 40 years we've been together, it's to get out of the way and let my wife speak. So with that, I am proud, very proud, to introduce to you the author of Aroused, Randy Hutter Epstein.
Thank you very much. As Stuart already said, I'm so grateful to be here tonight and to kick off the book tour here in Philadelphia, where we met, where I have so many ties. Writing a book is really tough. Letting my husband speak without interrupting him was really tougher. There were certain things it was a hard experience. They kind of held me back. But I think I've never actually heard him say a full sentence without my help, and I think you pulled it off. I didn't even know you could do it. So, wow, it'll never happen again, but that's okay. I want to begin with a story about my grandma. When I was a kid in Yonkers, New York, in the 1960s, I spent a lot of summers with my siblings going to my grandma's pool club. My grandmother and her three friends would sit at a table in the shade, smoking Kent cigarettes, drinking coffee, and playing canasta. My sister and I would play in the pool, but we were also determined to get tan. So we did what everyone did. You know, we took a record album and you put aluminum foil over it, and then you sit your chin in it just to make sure you get all the rays coming. And then we marinated in baby oil just to make sure we'd sizzle on top of that. You can probably tell from my complexion, I wasn't really the tanning type. I would burn to a crisp and then get back to my starting pale the next day. My sister had a decent tan, a really lovely bronze. But here's the thing. Grandma Martha, despite being under a canopy hidden from the sun, had the most gorgeous copper color. We were mystified, and yeah, a bit jealous. It wasn't until years later that we learned that Grandma Martha didn't have an enviable aptitude for sunbathing. She had a hormone ailment, Addison's disease, Her body didn't produce enough cortisol. That's a hormone that maintains a healthy blood pressure and strengthens the immune system. Cortisol is also a stress hormone. People with Addison's suffer from extreme fatigue, nausea, and low blood pressure. The disease also darkens the skin. When I was a kid, I didn't know much about her disease, except that John F. Kennedy had the same thing, which made it sound like a very presidential thing to catch. My memory throughout my life was just this. My mother saying, "Ma, don't forget to take your cortisone pill." There was one pill in the morning and one in the afternoon. Not even sure I knew Addison's was a hormone disease. To me, hormones were boobs and your period and sex. But hormones are so much more. They're potent chemicals that control metabolism, behavior, sleep, mood, and the immune system. When I delved into the history of hormone, I wasn't thinking about my family history. I delved into the history of hormones because the last century has been a period of incredible discovery and also outrageous claims. Consider this, it's pretty remarkable. When Grandma Martha was born in 1900, the word hormone didn't exist. By the time she was diagnosed in the 1970s, scientists had a way to spot her hormone defect. They could also measure hormones down to the billionth of a gram. A billionth. I'm not a numbers person, but when I told my husband about that great advance in medicine, his response was, "You don't mean a billionth." "No, I do. I mean a billionth of a gram. That's like one grain of salt tossed into an ocean, but it makes a huge impact." I'm going to be telling you about the woman who devised the technique that allowed doctors to measure hormones. Like Grandma Martha, she was a woman from New York City in the middle years of the 20th century. She doted on her kids and made home-cooked meals. Unlike Grandma, she got a Nobel Prize and revolutionized 20th century medicine. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So, what are hormones? Think about it. We use the word so much now, but really the cool thing about hormones is you have all these different glands. You've got like the pituitary in your brain or dangling off your brain. You have your adrenals, you have your testes, and then you've got like growth hormone, insulin, testosterone, estrogen, progesterone. So there's all these different things. And it used to be in the 1800s or before the 1900s, we studied glands, but the adrenal guys didn't really talk to the testicle guys, and we didn't really talk to the ovarian guys, because it was sort of as if you put like a neurosurgeon and dentist and said, "Oh, you should be the same field." So it wasn't until the early 1900s that people thought, "Oh no, there is this unifying thing of hormones." So it's a pretty simple definition. Does anyone want to give it a shot? Any endocrinologists, anyone know what a hormone is? That's good, and there's a little more to it. Anyone want to guess a little more? Okay, it's pretty simple. It's a chemical spewed from one gland, and they say hits a faraway target. So it's like we're not talking like Center City to the Poconos far away. We're talking like brain to ovary or brain to testes. But it's actually a pretty remarkable thing. So I just want to read a bit from my book about how I explain hormones. If you consider your body a vast information highway, a collection of messages being sent this way and that, your nervous system works like an old-fashioned operator's switchboard. It contains wires that need to be plugged into the source and the target in order to transmit signals. You can follow the path of a nerve from one end to the other. Hormones are a different story altogether. The remarkable thing about them, as opposed to any other substances in the body, is the seemingly magical way they work. Hormones are pinballed from one cell in one part of the body and reach faraway targets. No connections needed. They are your wireless network. Scientists would learn that every one of our cells has markers, like routers for computers, that direct the hormone signals precisely where they need to go. They would also realize that hormones rarely work alone. The job of the gland is simple, secrete hormones. The job of the hormone is trickier, to keep the body balanced. I love the Wi-Fi metaphor because I actually don't understand Wi-Fi at all. I can't even turn my television on. That's not an exaggeration. I cannot turn my television on. So I like being, I actually understand hormones, but I don't understand Wi-Fi. So it's kind of as a reverse kind of metaphor. What I'd like to do is the title of my book before we go on. The title is Aroused, as many of you are probably thinking, oh, just the way Ernest Starling thought about the word in 1905. So Ernest Starling in 1905 was the guy that thought, oh, we need one unifying field. He was the one that said, oh, all these chemicals work in the same way. We need a name. So he did what doctors do. They try to get like a fancy Greek word and come up with something. So Starling didn't know a lot of Greek, but his good friend at the University of Cambridge was a classics professor, and he said to him, give me a word in Greek that means to arouse, as in, obviously, arousing other cells, hence the fitting name. We're talking arousing cells. So his friend suggested, what about something along the lines of hormoa? And that's where we came up with hormone, and it stuck. Someone else, because doctors like to quibble or one-up each other, someone said, how about autocoid? Which, if you think about it now, like, you don't want to say, oh, my God, I feel so autocoital. That would be weird. But we might have thought it. But it's actually a good word because autocoid, he was thinking in terms of inner drug. And we kind of can feel that way about it. Someone else suggested, well, how about use the hormone word for things that excite and then calone. I'm not even sure how you pronounce it. C-H-A-O-L-O-N-E, which comes from the Greek to relax. But that didn't catch on either. So the other interesting thing about science is we give all the credit to hormones launched in the early 1900s, which is true, but there's always someone that did something way before to get things started that no one paid attention to. So what I'd like to do is show a little video about the very first hormone experiment. Is Jessica Pevner here? Okay, stand up, Jessica. So Jessica Pevner and Catherine McGeek are two of my undergrads who I didn't give them an assignment to do something for my book. That would have been really abusive. But I did this little extra assignment that most students did a little poster for, and Catherine and Jessica went overboard and did this amazing video. So after class ended, I was like, can you do a few videos for me for my book? And I want everyone to appreciate, Catherine's not here tonight, but Catherine and Jessica are pre-meds. They want to go to medical school. They're science people. They're not filmmakers. They're not animators. And so it's really wonderful what they came up with. So this is my words, their voice, their animation. And just give me a second to click on it.
Welcome to Highlights from Hormone History, a video series inspired by Randy Hutter Epstein's book, Aroused. The subject of this video is the world's first hormone experiment.
In 1848, Dr. Arnold Berthold conducted the first genuinely scientific hormone experiment on 6 roosters in his backyard in Germany. Many scientists then were curious about the testicles, whether they contained vital juices and how they worked. Could a testicle do its job if it were placed somewhere else in the body? Berthold cut a single testicle off of 2 of the roosters. He cut both testicles off another 2. In the remaining 2, he did an odd testicle swapping thing, removing both testicles and reinserting 1 in the belly of the other rooster. Each ended up with another bird's testicle in the wrong place. Here's what Berthold found. The testicle-free birds got fat, lazy, and cowardly. Their brilliant red combs faded and shrank. They stopped chasing female poultry. His unitestical roosters were the males, or rather the cocks, they had always been. They waddled, puffed their chests, and lusted after the hens. On autopsy, he found the lone testicle swollen. He reckoned it had swelled to compensate for the missing one. But the most stunning finding of all, the discovery that should have shocked the testicle research world, was the result of the gonad switching. Berthold had wondered whether testicles could function from anywhere in the body. They did. He had implanted a testicle between the intestinal loops of a fat, lazy, castrated bird. The young rooster, only 3 months old, had nothing between his drumsticks but a lone testicle in his gut. Yet he turned back into a full-fledged hen chaser, red comb and all. Berthold repeated his testicle-to-belly switch with another bird, and the same thing happened. Berthold had assumed that when he carved his poultry, he would find a network of nerves connecting the displaced testicles to the body. Instead, he found the testicles were surrounded by blood vessels. He wrote up the first explanation of how hormones work, writing that his experiment showed that the testes released a substance into the blood that was carried off to the rest of the body and reached a special destination. He was right. Hormones are released in one part of the body and reach a specific target like a well-aimed arrow from a bow. He didn't use the word hormone because it wouldn't be coined for another half century. No one listened. The specialty of hormonal science could have started right then and there, but it didn't. Berthold's backyard rooster trial could have been the paradigm-changing experiment, transforming the way scientists looked at internal secretions. He published his insights. Then, without fanfare, he moved on to other projects. As Albert Q. Maisel wrote in The Hormone Quest, it was as if Columbus had discovered America and then went home to spend the rest of his life studying the streets of Madrid.
Thanks for watching.
Thank you, Jessica, for making my talk more enlivening tonight. Now what I want to do is, you heard about my grandma, you heard the video from my student. I want to tell you, I'm not going to go through everything in the book, you can get that and read more, but I want to tell you a few stories. The next story I'm going to tell you, you're going to think, like, what does this have to do with endocrinology? Bear with me, I promise it will. So I'm just going to read two pages and it will get to endocrinology. On May 21st, 1924, two Chicago teenagers tried to get away with murder. Nathan Leopold, or Babe as he was called, was 19. Richard Dickie Leopold was 18. They were both students at the University of Chicago, born and raised nearby in one of the most exclusive neighborhoods in town. That afternoon, they left their college campus, rented a car, and drove to the Harvard School, and they waited. The two had schemed for months and thought they had covered every angle to avoid suspicion. They knew, for instance, not to drive Babe's red Willie Knight's car. That would be a definite giveaway. So they decided to rent a modest vehicle, choosing a blue one. They also lied to the Leopold's chauffeur, telling him that the brakes on the Willie's Knight needed fixing. That way, the chauffeur wouldn't worry about the rental. They also rented under a false name. Their alibi, just in case they got questioned, was going to be something about carousing all night with drunk girls. Babe and Dickie were brainy kids. They skipped grades, they started college by the age of 15, one of them was about to go off to Harvard Law School, but they were novice killers. They weren't as thorough as they thought. The boys had a short list of potential candidates, all sons of their parents' wealthy friends. They chose 14-year-old Bobby Franks only because he was the last to leave school that day and was alone. They waited for him near the schoolyard and lured him into the car by offering him a ride home so he wouldn't have to walk. Then they drove a few blocks and bludgeoned him to death. The corpse was found in the woods later that evening with a pair of expensive horn-rimmed glasses lying nearby. The cops traced them to a high-end shop that had only sold three pairs, one to Babe Leopold. Babe tried to explain it as coincidence. He was a bird watcher. He was in the woods a lot. They must have fallen off and he didn't notice. The cops didn't buy it. Soon enough, both boys confessed, each claiming the other the ringleader. The families hired famed defense attorney Clarence Darrow, the lawyer who would go on to defend John Scopes, the teacher sued by the state of Tennessee in 1925 for teaching evolution to public school students. For the Leopold Loeb case, Darrow turned to science too. His mission was not to prove the boys' innocence, they had pleaded guilty, but to get them life sentences instead of the death penalty. The murder was quickly dubbed the crime of the century. Newspapermen staked out the homes of the Leopolds and the Loebs. They packed the courtroom. The case would, years later, inspire four films. One starring Orson Welles, another directed by Alfred Hitchcock. A few books, some fiction, some nonfiction, and one play. But here's this, the driving question of all the newspaper reports, the films, and the novels, the question on everyone's mind was this. What compelled these two boys who had it all, education, money, connections, to toss it all away for an afternoon of gruesome adventure? What was the motive? You can imagine all the things that were brought up, what the tabloids said. Some people said, well, they were brought up by babysitters. They had their nannies, so that must have been it. Someone said, well, I think they were gay lovers. That must have been it. Someone said, oh, well, they were thieves. Someone found out that they had stolen from a lemonade stand years ago. Maybe that was it. Someone else said, well, they didn't go to synagogue enough. They only showed up on the high holidays. Maybe if they went more often, that would have helped. None of these whys and wherefores, not the mothering or the sex or the pilfering, pulled all these puzzling pieces together. But there was one theory that appealed to the doctors, to the lawyers, and a lay public hungry for a scientific explanation to explain deviant behavior. A newfangled notion gaining attention in medical journals and newspapers. The answer lay in the science of endocrinology. Endocrinology exploded in the 1920s from an obscure science to one of the most popular specialties. And you have to understand what was going on in the 1920s. It was kind of a wacky time. So at the same time when they were about to isolate estrogen, they were about to isolate testosterone, about to do all these wonderful things, there were people, shocking as it seems, that were grasping on to these tiny threads of real science and just going way off and extrapolating them. So there was a guy in Kansas who actually bought his MD, but he called himself a doctor without ever going to medical school, which you could do more easily in the 1920s. And he had a farm of goats, and you could go down and pick your testicles and have them implanted into you in his kitchen, and that was supposed to boost your libido. I think there were only one or two deaths they covered up from that, but it became hugely popular. You could buy things over the counter that claimed, we don't know what was really in it, crushed ovaries, crushed adrenal glands, all sorts of things. And there were things that, like, if you read the bottle, it would say, like, cures constipation, cancer, boosts libido, like, it went on and on, all in one thing, you know, fixes menstrual irregularities. So that was going on in the 1920s, around the time of this trial. The other thing you have to know is someone called Dr. Lewis Berman. He was really a man of this time. And let's just say that if Dr. Berman were alive today, he's not, he'd have his own TV show and a gazillion Twitter followers. Dr. Berman was an associate professor at Columbia University. He was a member of all the established elite medical societies. He published at least 40 scientific articles, and he did some real research. He was the one that isolated the hormone from parathyroid glands. That's the gland around your thyroid, and it regulates calcium. Yet, he was also a self-promoter and an audacious extrapolator. So Berman sort of hobnobbed with the literati and got very famous and wrote all these books, and he said things like, he can look at a person and know their hormone type. And he gave examples from history. He said Abraham Lincoln was a pituitary type. Oscar Wilde was a thymus type. He did this, remember, all before, like, we could even measure hormones and know what type or how many levels of anything there were in you. This is what he wanted to do, though. He said that what we need to do is have all children checked in school and using his method of sort of looking at their face and figuring out what type they were, and then if they were low or high, you could rebalance them. And he had this idea that we would eventually get a society, what he called the ideal normal, and that would mean tall, smart, handsome, and no need to sleep. He also promoted, and this is going to sound like I can't believe this is done in the 1920s, but think about it, it's done in 2018. He also wrote books with diets tailored to balance your hormones. They were huge bestsellers, and as one can imagine, like, a lot of people loved him. Margaret Sanger, the birth control person, she thought he was the greatest thing and helped promote him. Doctors loathed him. You know, they just kept trying to explain this is all nonsense. He said things like, women with irregular periods lacked feminine hormones, and they were at risk of becoming too manly and having behaviors such as being enterprising and pioneering and dominating because their ovaries were masculinized. He also said that criminals should be examined for hormone imbalances because he said murderers had too much thymus. Now we know your thymus has something to do with your T cells, the immune system. And they had too much adrenal hormones and not enough parathyroid. So this brings me back to what was going on then in this trial. And this was written up in the Daily News when they were reporting on this is how we're going to figure out like why these boys were. So Berman wasn't called into this trial. He did do a lot of studies on this, but Clarence Darrow did hire two hormone experts, and they came on in June 1924. And again, you have to picture that there were people constantly and reporters stalked outside the courtroom. And so these two doctors came in and they carried all this huge stuff with them. They brought their own x-ray machine. They brought something called a metabolometer, something to measure your metabolism. It was this huge thing that you had to breathe into. They spent days interviewing the boys, measuring all sorts of things. They came up with a 300-page, 80,000-word report. I'm not going to read the whole thing tonight. I'll just tell you the punchline. Babe Leopold had a calcified pineal gland, and Dickie Loeb, this is what they said without examining this, had a multiglandular disorder. Basically, what they were trying to say to the judge is, hey, their hormones made them do it. So the judge at the time, and there wasn't a trial by jury. It was really the judge. They had pleaded guilty. It was the judge trying to figure out what the sentence was. The judge, and I'm going to paraphrase what the judge said because he said it in a very judgy kind of way, but he basically said this, wow, this is exciting. Endocrinology sounds like a fascinating field. It's wonderful that we're doing all these things, great theories. You doctors have all these wonderful theories, but it's not going to get two kids off the hook for murder. So they were both sentenced to life sentence for murder and then an additional 99 years for the kidnapping. 9 months later, Dickie Loeb was murdered in jail by a fellow inmate. Nathan Leopold, and I didn't write a book on psychopaths, but you can think about this. Nathan Leopold was released after 34 years because he was considered a model inmate. What happened to him? He moved to Puerto Rico. He became a medical technician. He married Trudy Feldman, a doctor's widow, and he died in 1971. He donated his body to the local medical school, and we don't know if they ever really decided to measure his glands or see what was in him. It was probably just some first-year medical students using a cadaver, and they might not have ever known whose cadaver that they had. So here's a glimpse of some of the wacky stuff that's gone on with hormones. I want to talk about one other story tonight about a true scientist. So this is Rosalind Yalow, the Jewish woman from New York that I said is like my grandmother, except my grandmother didn't win the Nobel Prize, and she did. I actually talked to Rosalind Yalow's son and daughter. I emailed them today to say, I'm talking about your mom tonight. And they were very appreciative. I interviewed a lot of people that worked with her, and a lot of people that remember her as a tough woman. She was really tough. She was difficult to work with. She could only work with you if you were as smart as her, and that wasn't easy. After reading about her, I thought she deserves to be a tough woman. So let me tell you about her. She revolutionized medicine. I'm not going to go into all the science of what she did, but it's there in my book. But here's her story of how she became this scientist. She was born in New York, went to public school, graduated from Hunter College, a public college, and she was one of the tops in her class in physics. And so she said to her advisor at graduation, I love this. This is what I want to do. I want to become a physicist. This was the 1940s. Her advisor said to her, We love that you love science, but why don't you become a secretary for one? This isn't a joke. This is what happened. So she couldn't get any jobs. She couldn't get into graduate school. No one wanted her. She became a secretary for a scientist at Columbia University, thinking that she, once you were on staff, you could take courses for free. So she then figured she'll just pile on science courses. So she got this job for a scientist, and she told him that she'd like to take some free science classes. And he said, well, don't you think stenography would be the kind of class you'd like to take? That would help you. Eventually, she did get to get her PhD at University of Illinois because there were openings because most of the men were off in World War II. Rosignello's son said to me, my mother had no sense of humor, zero, zilch. I kind of think, and obviously I didn't know her, I never met her, I didn't know her, I think she did because she is quoted in her biography as saying, they had to have a world war just so I could go to graduate school. So on the right side, I'm not going to get into the science of that, but what she and her partner, Solomon Burson, he didn't get the Nobel because he had died before the awarding of the Nobel, but what they figured out, knowing the strengths of chemical bonds, is how to measure hormones down to the billionth of a gram. So picture this. Before Rosignello, we had no idea how to measure hormones. So you went in the night, well, they figured this out in 1959. It took off like in the 1970s. So in the 1950s, you thought you had a hormone issue. Your doctor could look at you and say, did you look too short? Did you look like you were gaining weight too fast? And then they might try some hormone therapies. There was no way to measure them at all, not even an estimate of measurement. Blood was not drawn. After Rosignello, we could measure hormones down to the billionth of a gram. This same technique is the same technique that's used to measure anything that used to be too scarce to measure. We would not have been able to detect the HIV virus without our radioimmunoassay. There would be no fertility treatments. There'd be no drug monitoring. Today, of course, we don't use the exact way that she developed it in 1959, but we do use techniques built on the same science that Rosignello used. I want to save time for questions, but I just want to have a few takeaways that you don't walk away from my hormone talk and think, like, what was this about? So crime and this Jewish woman from New York. So here's the takeaway that I'm trying to explain in the book, that the history of endocrinology really has some wonderful, brilliant, and compassionate scientists that have done amazing work, that have planted seeds. And let's see, oh, I did, I say this little drawing. This is not Jessica's, that's why it's kind of stupider looking. But so there are some wonderful scientists that have planted seeds that have been grown up into this huge tree, this metaphor of what endocrinology has become. Ever since the start of the field, there have been those that like to grab at this low-lying fruit and extrapolate it and have all these wacky claims. And that's going on now, and it was going on then. What I'm hoping when you read the book is that you'll be able to come away and have some idea of what's hype and what's real. A few other things I mention in the book, I'll just give sort of a few headliners. I have a chapter on transgender, what we know and what we don't know. There's huge advances now being made for the treatment of children who identify as transgender, who know down deep to the core that their anatomy does not match their gender identity. Hormones and hunger. For some people, all the willpower in the world will not stop them from eating. They have a hormone defect that compels them to eat. We're not talking about people who gain weight more easily. We're talking about it compels them to eat. And there are treatments now to help them. I just saw someone give like a little thumbs up. No, this doesn't mean that there's going to be a diet pill for all of us who don't have that rare hormone defect. Because guess what? And you might have known this before reading the book. Some of us eat even when we're not hungry. We're not compelled. It's just, oh, I have a book talk tomorrow, so therefore I need to go out and get ice cream. You know, that kind of thing. Sure, I'll have that extra drink, but not till after the book talk. That's not a hormone issue. That's just other stuff going on. menopause. I have a whole chapter on menopause, but I guard my audiences. When I speak to a group of women, I can go really into menopause and hot flashes. I just didn't think this was the audience that wanted to hear. But you want to hear all about menopause? It's here in the book, and I can talk about it or answer questions about it. Testosterone, a quick one-liner. If you are seriously really low testosterone, and that means two blood tests from an accredited lab, and you should make sure you can actually go to the CDC website and make sure that lab is accredited, then yes, if you go from really low into the normal range, you will get a boost of libido. You will have more energy. But, you know, if you're in that middle zone and you go from, like, I don't know, let's say you were 450 and you go to 550, like, you might, like, have fun, like, comparing the numbers to your friends at a bar. Do guys do that? I don't know. But it's just placebo effect. And now I just want to go back to Rosalind Yallo, because I want to end with one quote. So people, you know, would talk about what a difficult woman she is, and she had a right to be a difficult woman. And they said that ever since she won the Nobel, she signed all of her, everything she did, Rosalind Yallo Nobel Laureate. Good for her. She deserves to do that. And they also said that she wore her Nobel Laureate chain all the time. And her kids said, nah, that's not true. Though in the picture that I found of her, she was wearing that necklace. But here's what the kids said that is really true. On the back of her desk, she had this sign. To be considered half as good as a man, a woman must work twice as hard and be twice as good. It's like, okay, we've heard that one before. To be half as good as a man, a woman must work twice as hard and twice as good. But Rosalind Yallo added this. Fortunately, that's not difficult. And now, I guess the last thing I would just say, my only tidbit of advice is, yes, get aroused, whether it's by a book or however you feel like doing it. And I'm happy to open this up to questions.
Could you make an educated guess about whether you expect more hormones will be discovered?
Oh, that's interesting. I think I can't tell you how many, but I think yes, we will. And it's funny, the whole word hormone now has become, like, do you consider neurotransmitters hormones? Like, there's all these chemicals that we're not sure what to categorize them as. Neurotransmitters are your brain signals. They go from one place to a specific target, but they'll say, well, it's not really a hormone because they don't go far. Well, what do we consider far in the body? So yes, I think we're going to find out, I think that's going to answer a lot, more signals. I think we're going to find out not just more hormones, but we're going to learn about more helper hormones, like signals that depend. I also think that we're going to figure out, and we're trying now, not we, they, scientists are trying now to understand interactions between hormones and the immune system. So I think that's really on the forefront now.
Hello, thank you for your talk. Pardon if this is a layman's understanding, but I've recently been reading about epigenetics, which is like the effect of our environment on our genes and the possibility that trauma can be passed along to next generations. How do hormones fit into this bit of science that I'm just learning about?
Sure, hormones do fit in. It's interesting. I grappled with whether to go into this in my book, which I don't, but there's something that we call endocrine disruptors, and that's what people are saying, which is also along the lines of the epigenetics, because it can affect your genes, and then your genes make hormones. And what this is that there's, because of pesticides, because we're pumping up our cattle with hormones, how is that affecting our bodies? When you eat meat with a lot of hormones in it, when you drink water that pest chemicals have been dumped in, how do those chemicals affect our bodies and tap into our hormone receptors? Right now, from animal studies, when we take rodents and we try to put them in chemically awful water and we do all sorts of weird things like we're doing to our own world, we do see that there are impacts on them. There's impacts on the fetus particularly. But right now, it's very hard to pinpoint down and say, okay, your baby or your child has autism because of this chemical in the water. We're trying to figure all that out, but we're not quite there yet. You know, in Europe, they take more what they call a precautionary principle, and I think it's a good idea. When I say we're not there yet and we don't know, I don't mean to sound callous, like we shouldn't care. I think that we should take certain precautions without knowing the scientific data, like it might not be a good idea to pump tons of hormones into meat that we're eating. Do I think you're scot-free if you just eat vegetarian? No, probably not, because we don't know what's in that either. So I think we're at this way that we have to take some precautions, but we don't have the science there yet. But it makes sense that we're screwing things up. Yeah.
I don't even know if this is a question, but could you comment on the use of hormones such as birth control pill, tamoxifen, hormone replacement therapy?
Sure. I mean, that's, you know, it's a whole balancing act, and I think that women, you know, in terms of birth control pill and hormone replacement therapy, tamoxifen is a hormone drug given to women that have had a certain type of breast cancer. I think we've gone very up and down into like, oh, they're great, take hormones. There was, in the 1960s, every woman was like given estrogen, and the doctor that wrote the book about estrogen was actually funded by the estrogen drug company to write the book, but he didn't say that. So it was like, this is great. Then we found out that there's some dangers with hormone replacement therapy, so then no one wanted them. And I think we're learning now that everything you do has a risk and balance. So, okay, so I'll just reveal this. I didn't really feel like being this personal, but what the hell. So while I was writing the book, I wasn't sleeping through the night, and I was like, well, actually, no, I thought I was sleeping through the night. My husband wasn't sleeping through the night because I was, like, whacking him with pillows and, like, tossing it off all during the night, and then the next morning he'd say, gosh, you didn't sleep through the night, and I'm like, no, actually, I did. I think you didn't. But I was really miserable. But here I am writing a book about hormones and saying, oh, they're not dangerous if you take it. But then I was nervous for myself to go on them. And even my doctor was like, oh, you're not going to want to go on anything. And it was a friend of mine who, over martinis, was like, you haven't slept through the night in like a year. This is ridiculous. And, you know, you're having like panic attacks and you're sweating and you're miserable. Try it for a month. It's not going to kill you. So I do have to say I am on hormone replacement therapy. Oh, it works. Is it for everyone? No. There's lower doses than there have been. I'm not promoting them for everyone. I think there's non-hormonal things. But I do think now, I think women are wiser. I think we're not looking at, we're not saying, oh, it's a cure-all, and we're not saying you should be on it forever. What the scientists have told me, and but you still see this, is that we don't have any data to say what there was saying. Oh, hormone replacement therapy, you're going to lower your risk of Alzheimer's. No, the studies are not out there. You're going to lower your risk of heart disease. No, the studies aren't out there. What most doctors and what the clinical guidelines are now is, I mean, this isn't birth control, this is for hormone replacement therapy, is that for a lot of women, not all, it works for hot flashes, it works for other symptoms. But don't take it for any of those long-term effects. That because they were touted for a while as like, oh, this is going to be like the best thing and ward off every old age disease. The birth control pill, it's the same thing. Do you think, you know, I think, is it the most effective way to prevent birth? Yes, and it is still now. Are there lower doses than we had? Much. I mean, the original birth control pill was much higher doses. So I think we're trying to figure out what the lowest dose. I hope that answers. Mm-hmm.
What do hormones do? With regards to anxiety and panic in men?
Meaning, like, is there a link between testosterone or, you know, a lot of that we don't know. You know, cortisol is the stress hormone, but the truth of the matter is when the real way when we think of cortisol as a stress hormone is, like, if your body is under stress, if you've had surgery, you need cortisol to help boost the immune system. Your body's under that much stress. Emotional stress is very different, and it gets really complicated. There's all this stuff out there like, oh, as men get older, their testosterone goes down, their estrogen goes up, and that's what's making them more anxious. And actually, a recent study showed it's not this seesaw. I mean, they kind of, that, you know, testosterone can go down along with estrogen, so it's not this estrogen effect that's making men more panicky, but it's been written about. We really don't understand all the details. Yes, are hormones involved? You'd get this adrenaline rush. Yeah, one of the problems of looking at, of emotions and hormones is that you really have to look at the hormones in your brain, not the one, you know, you can't just like go for a run, let's say, and say it relaxes you and take blood from your arm and say this one up. You have to know what goes on in your brain, and you're not going to get like a biopsy every time you do to see. So are they involved? Yes. Do we know exactly how? Not really. It's still complex, but hopefully we'll get more of an understanding.
If you'll allow me to just preface this with like an anecdotal thing that I've observed, and I think it's a ripe field for research. For all I know, it's already been researched to death, but I know nothing of it, and I'm really curious. I've noticed two things, and this has been corroborated by others in my family. One, my son, being a very sensitive person, we found there would be times when he seemed to cry for no reason, and my wife would menstruate the next day. There seemed to be like the canary in the coal mine, really observationable about the effect of one person's hormones on someone else. I can't prove it was causative, but it really happened a lot. And the other thing is just an observation in myself. I have no idea if I'm being magnanimous or an asshole, but I think that not only was my wife frequently more irritable in the standard way that PMS is reputed to be, but I think I pushed a little harder, and I think I was a little more irritating frequently at those points, and was thinking, in the animal kingdom, you know, there's rams and apes butting heads and whacking each other with clubs when Fifi's in estrus. Is there something that this is all going to the hormonal effect on the surrounding people. You know, I know that in dormitories, the women all sync up and everything, but how much do men, like, behave differently, and children like my son?
Well, right, in terms of, well, first of all, that menstrual cycle synchronicity thing, there's a study done in the 1970s by a woman who I think is in Chicago still, and she did a study showing that that women who live together tend to then menstruate around the same time. It's such a flawed study. It should be like a case study in statistics. Basically, but it's still, it's like that myth still goes on, but it's actually not true. The problem with that study was, like, think about it, like, you have your period for 7 days. So that's like a good chunk of the month. Then, like, your roommate starts, like, on your day six and goes on. Wow, that was synchronous. No, actually, it kind of wasn't. So the study, like, you know, the study was, like, so flawed that way. So it's not true. We don't know. We don't know a lot about, probably not. Like, it sounds like, what I think is, like, probably, like, when I was going through perimenopause, I would say once a month, my husband became so much more annoying than any other human in the world. And it wasn't me at all, at all. I was just this solid base of, like, cheerful, like, really, like, tolerant person all the time. And then for a few days every month, he was just so grating, I just couldn't take it anymore. So I don't know. I think there's something in male hormones that has to do with that. In terms of this external thing, humans, there probably are some effects, but we don't really know. And, you know, there's this whole thing of human pheromones. It doesn't exist. So, like, if you're single and you're a woman and you're a silkworm moth, do we have any in the room here today? You can actually spew a pheromone, which is like an ectohormone. You can spew that hormone, and you can get your male silkworm moth like a slave to like come all the way back and find you and mount you. That's so, like, that's just female manipulation at its very best. But If you look at perfume ads, they would have you believe that we have these pheromones too. We don't. The silkworm moths have actually a thing in their brain that we don't have. I mean, I'm not saying they're smarter than us, but they just have this thing in their brain that they can do this. We don't have it. So do I think that odors affect? Yes, I think they probably flirt with your hormones. I think that there's probably these interactions, but we don't have it nailed down yet. So I think that really didn't answer your question, but it allowed me to tell a funny silkworm moth story.
Do you have any personal inclination toward notions of what is responsible for autism? And what do we actually know about the frequency of autism, let's say, in 1850, in 1750? I'm ignorant.
Okay, this is just, I'm actually fascinated that it's not caused by vaccines, that I can tell you. Without going way off on that tangent, vaccines don't cause autism. That was such a flawed study. I think I blame The Lancet for publishing that research. I blame the guy who did it. We really don't know, and I've really tried to piece that out. Apparently there has been a rise. There also is more diagnosis because we probably, if you're like my age or older, there were probably kids that you can look back on that were just considered weird and still thrown into mainstream schools, and these poor kids suffered without getting the proper diagnosis or help. So I think we are diagnosing more. I think there is an increase, and I really don't know why. You know, there's been theories of now looking at father's age. We never used to think about sperm, and there are theories looking into the impact of older men and sperm and how that affects children. The good news is at least we've gotten away. It used to be considered poor mothering. It was all the mom's fault. So we've gotten away. We know that's not it, but we really don't know. And I also think the issue now, which again has nothing to do with this book, but what I've looked into, is right now the word autism is a huge umbrella term for like any kid that just what we call on the spectrum. And I think once we can do more research and have more names and be more specific, then we can really figure out what's going on. Because I think one kid that has autism is very different from another kid with autism. You know, you hear people say my kid has autism, but he happens to be very social. My kid, you know, I think we're glomming together a lot of different ailments now.
Yeah, I don't remember if it was Yalow or maybe Morton Grossman used to say that hormones are just modifiers. Are just modifiers. They modify what you do, and there's nothing really profound about them. On the same type of question as the autism question, do you see certain things, and it's either traits or diseases or anything, that is really caused by a hormone of some type? Or are they just modifiers, like Morton Grossman said?
Well, look at diabetes. If we look at diabetes, that's a lack of insulin, so that's a clear impact. Do you mean that if we have a lack? I think there are thyroid diseases, if we have too much or too little, can cause. But I think you're getting at something. I don't think I'm answering your question right.
The non-hormonal syndrome, those are all hormonal.
Oh. So having a hormone defect and it causes sort of a non-hormonal thing. But I think we're finding out now that these things are related. So, I mean, I think there used to be people that were very anxious or, like, very anxious and thin and couldn't keep weight on, and we didn't realize, and now we're seeing it's thyroid. So I think what happens is once we link it to a hormone, then it becomes a hormone defect. So I think it becomes this circular question. Get aroused. Here it is. You can buy the book out there. Thank you. I really appreciate everyone for coming tonight.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.